Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
See ya. Good riddance. Don't let the door hit you in the rear on the way out. 2008 is done, ladies and gentlemen, and not a moment too soon. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the end of a year that we're going to remember for a while, everybody. It's Wednesday, New Year's Eve. And we were sitting around this morning trying to figure out how to give 2008 a swift kick in the pants as we leave it. As often happens at times like that, we asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, for his best ideas. We told him to go think about it for a while and let us know. But what Bob came back with is a more moderate reading of how bad things have really been this year. You're almost certainly sick and tired of hearing that the economy's taken its biggest hit since the Great Depression, and that's true. But Bob reminds us we were in pretty good shape coming into this whole thing.
It might be worth noting that we're heading into the new year with numbers that look a lot like those of 4 years ago. Gasoline prices are back to levels we haven't enjoyed since 2004. Inflation, the lowest since 2004. Home prices, back to 2004 values. You can even find a fixed mortgage at rates not seen since, well, you guessed it. So while it's true that key economic measures have suffered drops not seen in decades, and in many cases since the Great Depression, a lot of the actual numbers compare to more recent times. Robert DeYoung is a finance professor at the University of Kansas. He points out that especially with the housing market, the readjustments we've seen are relative.
If a strong economy declines, that can still leave us in a relatively good place. If a weak economy declines, that leaves us in a terrible place. So the decline in housing prices, in a way, is a correction because housing was overpriced. Painful as it is now, in the long run, the market always works.
Even if the market for stocks hasn't worked so well lately, it could be worse. While the Dow ends the year down more than 30%, China's Shanghai Index dropped 66%, and Russia's benchmark share index fell 72%. Still, Professor DeYoung reminds us that even those losses don't come close to the Dow's 85% plunge from its 1929 peak.
That's a mountain, and I wouldn't say this is a molehill, but this might be a foothill compared to the Great Depression.
At George Mason University, economics professor Russell Roberts is worried, though, about another year this might compare to.
I think the reason people are nervous is not that we're in 1933, which was the worst year of the Great Depression, but that we might be in 1930, on the precipice of what might lead to a Great Depression.
Roberts says whether we can all stop making these comparisons will depend keenly on whether government leaders succeed in making the tough choices looming in the year ahead. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Don't forget commodities as we put 2008 in the rearview mirror. Metals, grains, and the rest had their own troubles. Crude oil got back some of that today, up $5, about 14% to $44.50 a barrel. Along those lines, it's going to be a cold New Year's Day in Ukraine. Gazprom, the big Russian energy conglomerate, said today it's going to shut off natural gas pipelines to Ukraine tomorrow over unpaid bills. It's worth saying that that's not the first time the two have been at odds over energy. Never mind geopolitics for a second, though. Business makes its own strange bedfellows. At midnight tonight, SpongeBob SquarePants and Jon Stewart will have more in common than either might like to think about. Well, Stewart, anyway. Both could be casualties of a stalled licensing deal between Viacom and Time Warner Cable. Viacom wants more money for Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, and its other channels. Time Warner's not paying, as Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports.
It's a classic case of chicken, and with hours to go before its contract expires, Viacom has readied a series of TV spots that will air tomorrow in the event of a programming blackout.
You lost 19 of your channels.
Oh, no!
Call Time Warner Cable now and say,
no.
No! No!
Viacom shows like Dora the Explorer, South Park, The Daily Show, and others account for more than 20% of total cable viewers. But company spokeswoman Kelly McAndrew says the licensing fees Viacom gets for those shows don't match up.
What we are trying to do is simply to get an appropriate value for the networks that we provide.
But it's a tough time to pick a fight. Time Warner CEO Glenn Britt issued a statement today calling Viacom's request outrageous given current economic conditions. It's asking for an extra $35 to $40 million in licensing fees. TV consultant Larry Gerbrandt says passing that cost onto subscribers isn't going to be easy for Time Warner.
they really have two choices, either to eat it or to drop the channel. Neither are palatable.
And Gerbrandt says if Time Warner caves and gives Viacom more money, it opens the door to similar demands from other media companies.
It also sets the precedent for negotiations with every other cable network whose contract comes up for renewal.
He says that could cost Time Warner and ultimately consumers billions of dollars. But Viacom does have a secret weapon. If kids wake up tomorrow and find Nickelodeon blacked out, a lot of families may suddenly consider a switch to satellite TV. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
One would like to think the Treasury Department's big priority right now is fixing the economy. And it may well be. But a group of consumer advocates have something else in mind. They've written to Treasury Secretary nominee Timothy Geithner, asking him for nutritional labels on alcoholic beverages. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes it from there.
The Treasury Department collects excise taxes on alcoholic beverages, so it's been stuck with deciding whether ingredients have to be listed on labels. Michael Jacobson is executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. He says, sure, Treasury is busy saving us from economic doom, but consumers are thirsting for information on what's in their wine, beer, and liquor.
Artificial colorings, preservatives, foam enhancers, all kinds of things that we thought consumers had a right to know about.
The consumer groups even got manufacturers on board, although they don't agree on exact labeling. The Beer Institute joined the cause in 2005. Jeff Becker is the Institute's president. He knows Treasury's busy, but
I can fully appreciate what priorities are. That said, it's not a political issue at all. It's pretty straightforward.
Treasury has issued a proposed rule on labels, but it has to be finalized. So what's on a label now? To find out, I checked out the champagne at a downtown Washington liquor store.
Picking out a bottle of Brut, let me just turn it over, and about all they're telling me is alcohol, 11%, and it contains sulfites.
Nicole Engdahl was doing a little New Year's shopping in the store. Sure, labels are important, she says, but don't bug Treasury now.
You've got to be kidding me. We've got too many other problems right now that we need to focus on.
But Treasury is with the consumer groups in spirit. A spokesman told me he hopes a final resolution is reached in the near future. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There was just a little bit of bubbly on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The year's almost done, but sadly the financial crisis isn't. The World Bank says most developed economies are going to find themselves in recession come 2009. That would be the first time that's happened since World War II. And now, as then, a lot of European countries are especially hard hit. Our man in London, Stephen Beard, is with us to talk about that. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
For a dilemma that started here, Stephen, it seems to me that this entire crisis got very global very quickly.
Indeed. That's globalization for you.
Right.
We know what happened. I mean, banks in Europe, like banks in the Far East, banks around the world bought these packages of parceled up, you know, subprime loans. The mortgages went bad and the banks that bought them became so terrified and uncertain about the scale of their losses and the losses of other banks that they stopped lending to each other. But it doesn't by any means tell the whole story or explain the intensity of the impact of this crisis in some countries here in Europe. Spain and Ireland, for example, had hardly any exposure to U.S. subprime mortgages, and yet they look as if they're going to suffer the worst recessions.
Well, what else is at work then? What accounts for that?
Debt, it seems. Household debt and real estate. Those countries here in Europe which had the biggest real estate and debt bubbles are the ones that are going to suffer the worst, it seems, as those bubbles go pop. But, you know, there is an argument gaining ground here that globalization actually may have played a part in all this debt that has ballooned in recent years.
Well, then I suppose you could say we're just victims of our own success in globalizing the whole economy.
Yes, because, and this is how the argument runs, there is a downside to globalization, and that is that you get Western companies outsourcing, they're using cheap labor in poor developing countries. That has kept the lid on wages back in the West. And so, in order to make sure that those Western workers keep buying, in order to boost their purchasing power, central banks and governments in the West have encouraged people to take on more debt to keep consuming. So that is a possible downside to globalization and free trade.
And the next thing inevitably that we will hear then, I'd imagine, is some kind of argument in favor of protectionism.
Indeed. And of course, that could be dangerous, as protectionism undoubtedly made matters a lot worse during the Great Depression. You're seeing signs of it already. I mean, here in the UK, following the multi-billion pound bailout of the banking industry, there's been a lot of talk about propping up and subsidising great chunks of manufacturing too. And the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, has warned that Europe, in his words, could turn into an industrial wasteland if it doesn't prop up its manufacturers. So, you know, this is hardly a climate conducive to free trade, with increasing state help and pumping up subsidies and so on.
Well, how does the coming year then look, Stephen, from where you sit in terms of the economic relationship between the United States and Europe?
Europe has always regarded America and the American economy as a trusty locomotive to pull all of us out of trouble. And I think many European leaders are pinning their hopes on the Obama presidency, hoping that he'll unleash a massive stimulus package that will get Americans consuming again and buying European goods again. There is, however, one must say, the excitement over the Obama presidency has been sort of tinged with a bit of anxiety. Some of his campaign rhetoric did suggest that he's much more concerned about protecting American jobs than promoting free trade. So there is a nagging concern in some quarters here that he could turn out to be a protectionist president.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
If you think conventional stock markets, like, say, the NASDAQ, have been scary places this year, and they have, well, then brace yourself, because there is another way to buy and sell almost anything that Wall Street can dream up. It's called over-the-counter. And beyond subprimes and mortgage-backed securities, OTC might be yet another reason we're in this mess. Rico Galliano explains in this installment of the Marketplace Decoder.
Okay, to truly understand this thing, we got to take you back to the 1700s. And by we, I mean Mike Hatley, president of Westgate Horizons Advisors.
The New York Stock Exchange started in the 1700s. Before that, stocks actually traded in the general store.
A general store was like a retail outlet for stocks, and there were a bunch of general stores all over the Big Apple.
You would go to the merchant at the store if you wanted to trade a stock, and you would trade the stock literally over the counter.
Now, you know from going, say, shoe shopping, that it's tough to check out every shoe joint in town to find the best deal on that limited edition pair of Pumas. Same went for stocks. Different general stores might sell the same stock at different prices.
A number of people decided, including Alexander Hamilton, that it would be really a good idea if there was a central place to do all the stock trading, and they formed the predecessor of the New York Stock Exchange.
But even today, not every stock sells on the NYSE. Some don't sell on any exchange. Those stocks and many other financial products that aren't sold on exchanges still trade OTC, over-the-counter.
Over-the-counter trading is trading that's done in a unregulated market.
Jeff Carter is an independent speculator and a former director of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. He says unregulated is the operative word here. On a regulated exchange, traders can only work with shares listed on the exchange. OTC traders can sell anything they want, from penny stocks to complex credit default swaps. There's no middleman and few rules. Kind of like the old general store writ large. And it's not for everyone.
The average Joe on the street is not equipped to do over-the-counter trading, and they're also not probably big enough. These are big, big transactions. It's a professional market.
But recently, professionals have lost big in the OTC market, thanks to the unexpected collapse of big players like Lehman Brothers. So Carter says there are moves afoot to build in some safeguards. For instance, by creating so-called clearinghouses, which ensure traders can actually afford to make deals. And he says the government may consider some oversight, too. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Coming up, how kids and grandkids can put the economy into perspective.
You pay a little bit less attention to what the Dow is likely to do over the next quarter, and more to the underlying wealth of the nation.
But first, let's do the numbers. The relative handful of traders who showed up on Wall Street today managed to find a little cheer to cap an otherwise dismal year. The Dow Industrials added 108 points, 1.25%, to wrap things up at 8,776. The Nasdaq rose 26 points, not quite 1.75%, finished at 1577. The S&P 500 advanced 12 points, almost 1.5% there, ending at 903. Here, and I know you're waiting for it, is how the final damages for the year stack up. The Dow descended 34% of its value, its worst year since 1931. The Nasdaq posted its worst year ever, a loss of 40%. The S&P 500 ends the year down 38%, the worst since 1937. But keep this in mind, the S&P has actually bounced back 20% since its low mark just 5 weeks ago. Just saying. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. U.S. stock markets take a rest, no trading on New Year's Day. New Year's resolutions, if you're in California, one might be no more texting while driving, since it's becoming a law and all. And the International Year of Natural Fibers begins. The United Nations declared 2009 the Year of Natural Fibers because they are an important source of income for farmers, thus they play an important role in food security. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, we can usually tell what stories are going to generate the most emails from you, but one that did this year was kind of a surprise. It wasn't about the bailout or the market troubles or the election, although it was about change, hunting for nickels and dimes on the sidewalk. Back in August, our reporter Sally Herships met up with a family in New York City that's built a sizable savings, all from money found on the ground. We got part of the Humphrey family, Scott and his 5-year-old daughter Karen, on the phone to find out where the nest egg stands. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Good to talk to you.
How long have you guys been looking for money now?
We actually started about 2 years ago, off and on. The change pot really started to kick in last year. We've collected, I think last time we checked, was a little over 1,000.
Put Karen on the phone for me, would you?
Karen, just tell them what you do.
We pick up change on the floor, and we find change at the mall.
And where do you put it, Karen?
In the change pot.
Can you actually pick up your change pot, or is it too heavy?
Too heavy.
All right, good. Let me talk to your dad, would you?
Okay.
Hey, Scott, where is all the money now? What are you guys doing with it?
My wife put it in ING.
ING.
And,
it's in the bank.
Yes. Compounding interest. I think we're up around $1,200 or $1,300.
When you found out how much you were saving, I mean, how did things change? You know, nickels and dimes are great, but when you start getting up to $10, $20, $30, $40 in the bank, you really start thinking about it differently, don't you?
We became a lot more fiscal. When we would do our shopping, we'd be more conscious of what we were doing, and it actually kind of turned into a recycling thing, because when we're around the neighborhood, we find that then not only picking up change, but we're picking up, you know, we're helping beautifying our neighborhood where we live at in Staten Island.
Yeah, and which is great, but do your neighbors ever look at you kind of funny?
Oh, of course. Dad, one of my neighbors, he walks with $3. He goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "I found a nickel." He goes, "It's only a nickel." I said, "Well, for you, it's only a nickel. For me, it's $1,197.25. And he's like, "What?" And I told him, he's like, "You did not." But I'm like, "That's okay. You can think I'm nuts. And when I'm on the plane flying to Hawaii, we'll see who's nuts."
How much longer do you think you're going to keep this up? Or are you going to do it forever?
I'll probably do it forever. I'll probably incorporate my kids with it, because when they move out, they can start, it'd be like change pot part one, change part two. When my kids start learning how to blog, we'll probably have them start their own.
Scott Humphreys and his family look for change wherever they go. We did a story on them back in August. That blog he was mentioning, you can find a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. While you're there, you can listen to the story that Sally Herships did for us. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. You'll have a wonderful, happy new year.
Seeing as how none of the experts seem to have a real handle on the forces moving this economy, and nobody's doing a particularly good job of predicting how it's all going to turn out next year, we figured why not try another prediction racket altogether? We sent Mitchell Hartman from the entrepreneurship desk up at Oregon Public Broadcasting out to see what astrology has to say about our economic fates.
So, what's going on in the heavens that's moving the economy?
The big thing right now is Pluto.
That's Jonathan David, president of the Oregon Astrological Association. He says Pluto's a very disruptive force, and it's wreaking havoc everywhere from central banks to stock markets. As astrologer Susan Davis explains, Pluto is now in the constellation Capricorn in the sky.
Pluto is at 0 degrees Capricorn. The last time that happened was 1776, the American Revolution. The country has a big change coming.
Pluto's move into Capricorn happened during the fall, just around the time Fannie and Freddie and AIG were collapsing, and Pluto moves slowly, so it'll be causing upheaval in Capricorn until 2023. So is planetary motion a plausible explanation for economic motion? I tested the theory with Jonathan David.
Pluto is going to be going significantly through the U.S. Chart of the eighth house, the house of mystery and death and rebirth.
Maybe not. But then I met Dina DiCastro, a very serious counseling astrologer, who sees the heavenly bodies as indicators rather than causes of events down on Earth.
I don't believe that the planets actually make things happen so much as they reflect a larger order to things.
So back to Pluto. For 15 years, the powerful little planetoid has been slowly moving through the constellation Sagittarius.
Sagittarius has to do with expansion, with growth. The shadow side of Sagittarius is about overextension, over-optimism.
We know where that got us, the delusion that home prices would go up forever and everyone getting subprime mortgages, then buying Hummers on credit to put in the driveway. By contrast, Capricorn, where Pluto has now arrived,
is about looking at things coldly and starkly and with an awareness of what's real. And in fact, it can be kind of oppressively bleak. It's like the energy of a bubble bursting.
Which made me wonder, how's the astrology business faring in a looming Capricornian depression? Susan Davis sees walk-in customers at the back of a psychic accessories shop in Burbank, California. She says a lot of her colleagues are hurting, but she is booked solid. Her secret isn't in the stars. She's quick and cheap.
Because I'm just basically what's going to happen type person. Not what your personality is or what you're thinking or feeling. I don't care. I just want to know what's coming in your life. And 15 minutes will do it.
At $20 a pop. To be honest, all this has me feeling a little guilty. I'm a Capricorn. But DiCastro says, no, the world needs Capricorn's pay-as-you-go, get-real, stick-to-the-budget discipline right now. Sorry, everyone. Party's over. Pluto's in our sign now. Returning to Earth, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We have charts for President-elect Obama and incoming Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, both Leos, by the way, as well as the Federal Reserve itself, which is a Capricorn if you go by the date in 1913 that the Federal Reserve Act was passed. You can check our website for them. It's marketplace.org. It's an understatement to point out that this has been a year for the history books, politically, economically, of course, and for commentator Robert Reich, personally.
The biggest thing to happen to me this year was the birth of my first grandchild, a little girl named Ella. Now, I know this kind of thing happens all the time, and frankly, I get a little bored with people who go all gushy about the birth of kids or grandkids. I'm bringing Ella up not so much because she's special. Of course she is. But because she was born right in the middle of the worst economic downturn in my lifetime, and probably yours, and maybe even hers. Ella came with a crash. Like almost everyone else, I've lost a big chunk of my savings. And the house I bought here in Berkeley at the very top of the housing boom is probably worth a lot less than I paid for it. I'm not too worried about my job because I have tenure here at the University of California, although maybe I should worry because the state is technically bankrupt. My point is that relative to Ella, it's all, well, sort of irrelevant. Okay, maybe I'm going all gushy. But that's the point. Having kids or grandkids expands your focus and also your time horizon. You pay a little bit less attention to what the Dow is likely to do over the next quarter and more to the underlying wealth of the nation. Not just its gross domestic product, but its gross domestic decency, if there were such a measure, the quality of our public schools and of our atmosphere, the extent of our generosity to one another. You find yourself paying less attention to the gossip surrounding Bernie Madoff or Rod Blagojevich than to the larger questions they raise about greed and public morality. Which brings me to today and tomorrow and beyond. I wish you not just a prosperous new year. On that score, 2009 may be something of a bummer. Now, I wish you and your kids and grandkids and Ella a good and peaceful and generous new year.
As he said, Grandpa Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Super Capitalism. Take a minute to share your thoughts with us on grandkids or anything else. Our website is marketplace.org. Look at that link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, in which we take a moment to say some farewells, nothing you didn't expect given the way the year has gone. Merrill Lynch, Wachovia, and National City are no longer with us. They have been swallowed by bigger and better capitalized competition. And as of today, they've been booted from the S&P 500 stock index. It was a rough year for financials in the S&P. The sector overall was down more than 50%. And a lot of financials lost their places in the index. Bear Stearns, Countrywide, Fannie and Freddie, the list goes on. We, however, do not. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this New Year's Eve. Today, the Dow hiked up 108 points, 1.25%. The NASDAQ rose 26 points, almost 1.75%. The S&P 500 added 12 points. That is almost 1.5%. The yearly numbers, you don't even want to know. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson, Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, the key to cutting back on spending, it turns out, is old-fashioned peer pressure.
We all try diets on our own. It's just too hard to do. But put it in a group setting, put it in a competitive type setting, and the results are amazing.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a happy new year. You can join us for that story tomorrow.
American Public Media.